everybody. Welcome back. Thank you very much for tuning in. You are listening to the Dom and Colin podcast. My name is Colin. I'm here with Dom. Very special episode today. Dom, how are you?
I'm okay, even though the world is apparently collapsing all around me.
Yeah, how does it feel to be a free man?
Well, I guess we'll get into that over the next however long this lasts. But to answer the question, I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. We are back today. Dom, we have done probably somewhere in the neighborhood of like 220 or so podcasts together at this point. Every single one of them has been about television. Today, for the very first time, we are going to talk about something that is not a TV show. We're going to talk about what's going on over in your home country of England, the hashtag Brexit and everything that's going on there.
Yeah, talking about the end of the world as we know it. And I feel like talking about pointless reality television for however many hours we've done it for now has suitably prepared both of us for talking about this.
Are you guys only doing this for the hashtags? You just think that Brexit would make for a great hashtag and you wanted to get some like recognition? It's just been a long time since England had been in the news.
That's my understanding of it. Yeah.
Okay. Sounds good. So Dom, yeah, basically as far as what I understand, as far as what's happening there is very little. Basically all I know is that England has decided that they no longer want to be part of the EU, the European Union. So I'm hoping you, Dom, can shed some light on all of this for me and how it got to this point and where we are heading.
Yeah, and the fact that you said England there instead of the UK is accidentally very perceptive, but we'll get onto that in a bit.
The accidentally perceptive is my specialty, Dom. Yeah, all right. Well, first, I think, like, I really want to stress, I think it'd be good for both me and most of the people listening to hear from you in just as basic terms as we can realistically make it here. So let's start just at the beginning for me, which is, what is the European Union and why did England want to get out of it? What's in it for England in leaving?
Okay, so as you said, we'll focus mainly on the background and on the political climate as it stands right now. Probably leaving most of the policy debates aside, a lot of that ground has been fairly well trodden, and you can go out there and find the debates over that if you want. We will answer some questions to that degree towards the end, I would imagine, or just peppered in throughout the discussion, but we'll focus mainly on the kind of basic facts of the situation for now.
Right. I know I'm personally blue in the face over all the time I've spent debating British politics, so we'll save that for later.
It's a welcome break from debating American politics, I would say. But so basically, the question of what is the EU is, like, it's a fundamental one, obviously, and it's quite complicated. So initially, you're back in the late 1940s, early 1950s, coming out of World War II and the desire for greater unity within Europe to patch up a lot of the geopolitical differences that obviously came out of the Second World War. There was desire from a lot of quarters for like an overarching political union. So there was a fairly large Federalist camp who wanted a European state, essentially, to focus on all of foreign policy, domestic policy, and so on to some degree. Those kind of grand visions at the start obviously would not instantly materialize. So the people who were committed to that decided to work towards it fairly incrementally. What you did have in those initial days is a series of much looser and much narrower in scope economic arrangements between various countries that are now part of the EU. So, for instance, you had the European Coal and Steel Community between France, Germany, Italy, and then the Benelux countries, which established this authority to manage the coal and steel industries in those countries. And you had a series of arrangements like that coming up over the years. And then running in parallel to that, you had what I mentioned just now, which is this move towards a political union. So there are various moves towards that. The UK enters this scene in 1963, where it tries to join what was then the European Economic Community, gets vetoed by the French, so you have them to blame for all of this. And it isn't until a decade later, in 1973, that we apply again and are accepted this time. And when that application was accepted, we had a referendum on that in 1975, so just over 40 years ago now, where the question on the ballot was, do you want to remain or leave the community? And the remain side, or yes, as it was known then, won by a pretty decisive margin. So getting from there to the quite startling result that we had this morning has been a fairly long and story journey in itself, but that's the initial background, at least.
So the EU is like the big group majority alliance, and now you guys are finally, after several decades, wanting out of the alliance. Why do you want out? What's in it for you guys to leave?
So it really depends on who you ask, and that's the thing. So what you have in this referendum is, on the Remain side, you have the leaders of the main political parties, you have a majority of MPs of all of those parties, you have most major figures in media and industry, you have the you have international corporations, you have the Confederation of British Industry, which is like the main like the Chamber of Commerce equivalent in the UK. You have Obama weighing in and saying he supports Britain staying in the EU. You have a lot of foreign leaders weighing in to say that they support the same. On the exit side, you have a handful of conservative politicians in the UK, a very, very scattered handful of politicians in other parties, and then a bedrock that we're seeing develop in this election of nationalist support and working class support that hasn't really been effectively channeled in British politics in quite some time.
Is that UKIP?
That is UKIP, yeah. And there are lots of voters there who don't necessarily identify with UKIP, but who were on that side for this referendum in all but name.
Okay, let's get into this. And this is so far, because this whole issue has only really been on my radar just from talking to you for the last couple of weeks. And I know for most Americans, it probably wasn't until John Oliver this past week. I know your favorite John Oliver did his episode talking about this, that this became on our radar. And Nigel Farage was part of that, the leader of UKIP. Get into what UKIP is and who he is and how he's kind of been like ringleading all of this.
So the UKIP is the UK Independence Party, which I think would... It's hard to come up with an exact American equivalent because of the nature of the two-party system over there. But most European countries have that kind of nationalist party where they channel a lot of the same anger and resentment, and they attack the existing establishment in the same kind of way. And so Nigel Farage is an interesting choice as the frontman for that, given that he was a former investment banker. He comes across as this very high and mighty figure who tried to reinvent himself as the voice of the people.
Yeah, to me, at least just based on what little I've seen of him, as this story continues, I'm really hoping he becomes the Ken Kratz figure of Brexit.
He basically is already. Like, even a lot of Brexit voters don't have full confidence in him. And he is a hate figure among a large segment, a very large segment of the British population. And he, in case you're not familiar with him on a personal level, he is a... he is not quiet, let's put it mildly. He is a caricature of what you might expect someone like him to be like, essentially.
Well, how did this happen? And a question that we got, I sent out a tweet saying, hey, we're going to do this podcast. If you would like to ask a genuine, authentic British person your hashtag Brexit question, now would be the time. A good friend of the show, Antonio Mazzaro, everyone loves Antonio, wanted to know, while we were talking about just the difference between the American two-party system and the impact that UKIP has had here, could this have even happened if it had been a two-party system? Or is it giving fringe parties like UKIP a voice part of the root cause here?
So what I think you would get in a two-party system is essentially what you're seeing with Trump in the Republican primary, where that segment of opinion, if you like, is folded into whichever party happens to be the closest, even if that party, in any kind of objective terms, is quite far away from it. So with Trump, you have a lot of longtime Republicans who are balking at the idea of Trump having anything to do with their party or being anywhere close to being their nominee. And I think that's the same kind of thing you would get if, let's say, UKIP was folded into the Conservative Party, where it would exist somewhere on the fringes and the mainstream really wouldn't like it or accept it, but it would be hard to really do anything about it. So in Europe, what you often have, and you see this with the UK, is two major parties roughly corresponding to the traditional left-right spectrum. And then you have a number of smaller parties, often an environmentalist party, often a far-left party, a far-right party, a variety of smaller parties representing various concerns. And so in the case of UKIP, they have existed on the fringes of British politics for quite some time. And it's only in the past 5 years or so that they have really gained any traction.
Well, is it, do you think, along the same kind of lines as what we're seeing with Trump here, where people are speculating that it's not even so much being on board with all of the particular politics, just kind of the rise up against the government or against the man kind of candidate, or that kind of movement that, you know, gaining some traction?
Yeah, there's definitely a sense in which this referendum for a lot of people was a proxy for a wider political struggle that hasn't really been articulated in the mainstream yet. And I think this is what you're starting to see all across Europe and with Trump in the US, where a lot of what used to be like the working class Democrats, the working class Labour voters, feel that they're no longer effectively represented by whatever the dominant left wing or centre left party is in their country. And so they break off and are easy targets, if you like, for nationalist politicians who are trying to gain support.
I mentioned that this has only been on my radar for certainly less than a month. And for most people, they probably didn't hear about it until like this past weekend. How long has this been an issue like brewing up in England?
So you have to go back quite a long way. So the UK, even from the moment we joined, we've always been, by quite a big margin, the most Eurosceptic country in the EU. We've always had like this half in, half out relationship, and we've been uneasy about fully committing to it, but at the same time we want to have our foot in the door and not be shut out until now. And it's so to give a quick potted history of that. So the Yes campaign, the campaign to stay in, wins fairly decisively in 1975, and that puts the question of our membership to rest for a generation. That there was no real support in the short term, at least, for any kind of reversal of that decision or desire to rerun that, have that go again. What you did see in the years after that is, as the EU moved towards quicker and more comprehensive political integration, there were lots of people who maybe were ambivalent over the initial decision, or who supported it at first, believing that it was only ever going to be an economic arrangement, who were not happy about the political integration that they saw creeping up and being imposed on them. So during the 1980s, famously, Margaret Thatcher, who is basically a symbolic figure for both sides of British politics and the referendum campaign. So there were lots of people, you know, on the Brexit side who held her up as a hero. There were lots of people who were kind of disgruntled former colleagues or supporters of hers who still supported her to some degree, but were uneasy about how critical she was at times of the EU. And then there are lots of people on the left who mostly now are overwhelmingly supporting Remain, for whom she is the bête noire. She is the hate figure of British politics, and a lot of
she's the Hillary,
pretty much, yeah. And a lot of what they
except backwards, I guess. She's on the wrong side of it, but you right. know what I'm saying.
But a lot of what they identify as the root causes of problems in British society and politics can be traced back to her, as far as they're concerned. And her relationship itself during the 1980s with the EU was very complicated. So she was one of the leaders of the Yes campaign back in 1975, back when it was the Conservatives who were mostly supporting in, and it was a majority of Labour members who favoured withdrawing. And back in the early 1980s, when Labour was a more traditional left-wing working-class party, they were the ones who were saying that this is essentially a stitch up by big business to get terms which are favorable to them, and whatever, you know, only by withdrawing and reclaiming our sovereignty can we stand up for workers' rights here in the UK and have proper solidarity with other groups abroad. And that got switched on its head during the early 90s, and we'll get there in a second. But Margaret Thatcher, so she was a very strong supporter of IN initially. And then when she got into government, she found that working with them was a lot more trying than she had expected it to be. And she worked hard to negotiate a rebate, so essentially an opt-out and a refund for a lot of the contributions and laws that the UK would have to adhere to within the EU. And so having achieved that, she was taking these cautious steps towards further integration, believing that she could limit it when that occurred. And so the big treaty during the 80s, which is the Single European Act, not to get too bogged down in technicalities here, but that was a treaty which...
Yeah, definitely not. Don't want to do that. I would not want to do that.
It'd be tragic. But that was a treaty which really cemented that, okay, we are going to have a political union, and this is the first real major step towards it. And she had that passed and then quickly came to regret that. And this was a major issue within the Conservative Party at the time, and would remain so up until the present day. And then in the late 1980s, after she had just won her third general election, so politically she was in a pretty good spot, but she was facing increasing criticism from within her own party, and also she was starting to go off the rails a bit politically, and it was Europe that would eventually be a big factor towards doing her in. The European Commission at the time had a new president, Jacques Delors, who was basically the opposite of Margaret Thatcher in every way, including her stance towards further integration. And they had some very public arguments over what the whole project meant, what it should mean, what Britain's position in that project should be. She gets turfed out in 1990. Before that happens, though, she's losing political power. Her chancellor and foreign secretary advise her to join the ERM, so the exchange rate mechanism, which is like this economic arrangement involving the relative positions of the currencies at the time, essentially. So she gets turfed out. John Major, who was one of the key figures in pushing her towards that, becomes prime minister. And so in 1992, he wins a fourth general election in a row for his party with a very narrow majority. So already this tension over Europe is more relevant than it was in the past, because these Eurosceptic MPs in his party have a lot more relative influence now that his majority is very slender. So he wins an election almost immediately. The UK crashes out of the ERM in one of the greatest hits to the value of the pound until today, basically.
Right.
And that destroyed any reputation that the party had left for economic competence and credibility, and also threw up new questions about what Britain's role should be in the EU. As this is going on, there are negotiations for the next big treaty that's going to consolidate integration even further, which John Major succeeds in forcing through Parliament against the wishes of a lot of his own MPs. And after that point, it was basically open warfare within his own party, and he was unable to really get anything meaningful done in the few years that he had left after that. So that's where we are going into the late 1990s. So I apologize to anyone who has already tuned out at this point, but this segment is not going to take that much longer. So 1997, we have Tony Blair comes into office with a massive majority. It's a new dawn has broken. It's a new political order, essentially. And when he took over, one of his first steps in reforming his party, which was a quite lengthy and painful process, was shifting their position more heavily towards embracing the EU. And so when he gets into office, he and his Chancellor, Gordon Brown, are divided over a lot of things, and that includes how far the UK should be committed to the EU. But between the two of them, they are a lot more pro-EU than any British government before that point, essentially. So the debate, as we reach the turn of the century, the turn of the millennium, is should the UK join the euro? And a lot of these same figures on both sides of the debate were present at that time as well, making the same arguments, essentially. And so if you go back and look at a lot of the speeches and arguments that were being made then, you can see the seeds being sown for what you would see during this campaign.
So from Tony Blair, was there anyone in between Tony Blair and now current Prime Minister David Cameron, or I guess not even current, no longer current Prime Minister David Cameron, who as of like a few hours ago has now stepped down? Was there anyone in between that? Because here's the list of British people in politics, not counting like your royals, that I know of. I know David Cameron, I know Tony Blair, I know Margaret Thatcher, and I know Winston Churchill, and that is the end of the list. So is there anyone else that I need to know? Historic, I guess John Major now played some key roles here.
Right, so you had Gordon Brown, who I just mentioned,
sure,
taking over
the Chancellor.
Blair, but yeah, that was like the intervening period. So the UK ends up not joining the euro, and there were a lot of people in the Labour Party at the time, and also in the media and industry, who were forecasting absolute calamity if the UK didn't join the euro. They said that we would lose our influence in the EU and with other foreign trading partners, that economically we would suffer, that our currency would plummet in value and so on. A lot of that either didn't come to pass or proved to be somewhat exaggerated. And that, I think, steeled a lot of people in the coming years against believing those sorts of arguments again. And so you see this time around, one of the central talking points is you have all of these experts, you have all of these senior figures lined up on the Remain side, and on the Leave side, you have no one of any credibility. And the counter argument that often gets made is, well, a lot of those figures on the Remain side have lost their credibility as well.
Okay, I think that's a question, or there is a question that I want to ask that maybe you don't know the answer to, because that's what I've heard as well, is that all of the like credible resources were saying, hey, this is going to be economically a disaster if we don't remain here. Back then, did the market kind of go crazy those first couple of days anyway? Because my larger question is, was the market, as we're seeing now, like as you already referenced, the British pound being weaker against the dollar than it has been in since, you know, the times you were just talking about 30 years ago. Was that going to happen either way, or is that a direct result of you guys leaving?
So when we were forced out of the ERM, the markets went completely haywire, and that was the biggest single episode of turmoil on the markets, I believe, from Britain's perspective in quite a long time up to that point. When we declined to join the euro, I think that was something that most people saw coming. Gordon Brown, who was the Chancellor at the time, had announced a series of tests, essentially, which any proposal to join the euro would have to pass. And it was clear, based on his criteria, that it was unlikely to meet those. And so you had people who were maybe disappointed with the outcome, but who saw that outcome coming and who didn't, you know, they weren't completely blindsided by it the way that almost everybody, including most people on the Brexit side, were by the events of this morning. So today, what you see is nobody expected this, and nobody knows what's going to come next. And that contributes in large part to the massive drop in the value of the pound, in the massive uncertainty that you see surrounding the UK's economic stability at the moment. And it's unclear, you know, less than 24 hours after the result, if that is just an overcorrection to the overconfidence of the markets in the other direction, where we saw in the days leading up to the campaign, the value of the pound rose because everyone was anticipating a pretty solid Remain vote? Or is this going to be the new permanent order of things and we're going to have to try and climb our way back up in the abyss?
Yeah, I want to get into just like what you were thinking about as all of this was going on before the vote ended up coming in. And a question we also got on Twitter from Matt McDonald, he asked how much win equity you thought Leave had pre-vote, like how likely you thought it was that this was actually going to come in.
Yeah, so when I made my obligatory Facebook post talking about what I thought was going to happen, what I wanted to happen, I said I fully expected Remain to win by a fairly solid margin. The polls looked pretty close, but most of them favored Remain. There was some movement towards Leave in the last week or so, but I thought a lot of that was what you often see where in referendums where the side that's for some kind of dramatic change picks up in like the penultimate push towards election day, and then in the last push towards election day, you see people come back towards what's seen as a safe option, and I thought that was going to happen here. Instead, what we got was an outcome that, as I said, no one really expected. The markets didn't really expect it. The media didn't expect it. The polling companies certainly didn't expect it. There are only one or two that even thought Brexit had a decent shot as the campaign was closing up. And Nigel Farage, who was one of the most prominent figures on the Brexit side, conceded defeat in the referendum and then had to unconcede Al Gore style when it became clear that things were swinging his way. So I think that's a lot of what you're seeing in the markets this morning, where you have these stockbrokers waking up and finding that everything they'd assumed, all of these political certainties, have just collapsed from underneath them, and they don't know what to do. The people that they're interacting with and doing business with don't know what to do. And it's going to take... It might take a while before things get back to relative normalcy. I mean, someone was saying that the level of the pound at the moment, before the US markets opened, so bear that in mind, was back to where it was roughly a few months ago when it dipped for a while. So maybe not complete catastrophe in the short term, but again, if this spirals under control, which it certainly could, then we could see it just plummet and plummet even further.
How is this a 100% locked in thing? You guys are definitely out now, or is there some way you can take this back?
So there is a vote for out. There is a clear majority for out, however small that majority might be. However, the referendum itself is not legally binding. And so hypothetically, the government could decide to either not go through with the negotiations, or I think what's the more likely case is the negotiations stall and some alternative arrangement has to be worked out before they can either start again or just be on the table whatsoever. So at the moment...
Is that likely at all?
So that's one of the many issues that logistically any effort is going to have. So as I said, you have a solid majority of MPs in all major parties who backed Remain and who would prefer to see that outcome but have accepted the referendum result as legitimate. However, whoever becomes prime minister, and we're not sure who that's going to be, whatever deal ends up being negotiated is going to have to be put through parliament. There's going to be a strong push for that prime minister to seek a mandate via a general election or to in some way legitimize the negotiations that they would be taking, given that no one would have voted for them, and voted for that person who becomes prime minister. And so the logistics of it, just from the outset, are very daunting. And the one precedent that we have is not very encouraging in that regard. So when Greenland left the EU back in the 1980s, and this is an island of with a five-figure population back in the time when we had many fewer treaty obligations and many fewer initiatives that we were tangled up in, that process of negotiation took them 3 years, essentially, to work through. And so at the moment, Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, which is the thing that would be invoked to get all this, to get this process in motion, that puts a two-year cap on how long negotiations can take before either an agreement is passed or the treaties that we're currently part of just become dissolved as far as we're concerned. So that might provide an incentive for everyone to get their act together and make something happen within that time frame. But Britain, compared to Greenland, is like a completely different situation. Like we are the fifth biggest economy, or the sixth biggest now that France has overtaken us because our currency has depreciated so far.
did you drop in the rankings today?
We did. We're going down in the power rankings officially. So that effort by itself would take a very long time. And you can imagine, let's say that isn't in place properly before the next general election. Like if it coincides with that, that could be messy. If you have a prime minister or a government that doesn't have a solid majority to get that through, then that would have to be handled in some way or renegotiated or something. And so the actual process of getting this through, no one really knows if it's going to work or if it can work or how it would work. So that's all up in the air at the moment. There have also been calls from a lot of disgruntled Remain supporters to just ignore the referendum and just say, well, you didn't know what you knew, what you should have known. You didn't do your research properly. This shouldn't have been left up to you in the first place. I think taking that stance or ignoring the result would be politically suicidal for any party that attempted it. I guess maybe if they had some kind of like collective suicide pact almost where all the major parties agree to not recognize the result, then no one party would fully bear the brunt of that, but that wouldn't be politically possible, first of all, and also like the minor parties would just vote in support to such a degree that things would be all up in the air again.
Yeah, well, I want to ask about that. This is something that a good friend of the show, Pia, sent me a link to on Twitter, a clip of Nigel Farage on some talk show being asked by the anchor, and I know you saw this as well, about basically some financial figure essentially being a liar, like what he promised to do with the money or where it was going or whatever, not actually being the reality, and him being like, well, I guess, hey, you know what? The votes have already been cast. Nothing we can do about it now. Merely like whatever, 10 hours after the votes were cast.
Right. The tone of this campaign has been completely unedifying, and it really does not do our country any service at all. So on the Remain side, you had a lot of outright condescension and hostility towards the working class voters that they predicted would go for UKIP, and which used to be solidly in their camp, but who feel alienated now and been driven away. And a lot of what I think at best are fairly disingenuous arguments for why we should remain. On the other hand, on the Leave side, you just have some outright bullshit artists like Nigel Farage and various others who know that what they're saying just isn't true or just don't really care, but who know that that kind of argument is going to resonate with the public. So in the example that you're mentioning, one of the arguments that really swung it for the Remain side in the last few weeks was, well, if we take this money back, and that the figure was $350 million, which almost everybody outside of that agrees is a solid overestimate, then we could take that money back, we could spend it on the NHS instead. And so this works because the NHS in British politics, I don't need to explain to an American how contentious healthcare can be as a political issue, but the NHS in the UK is kind of like a civil religion almost. It's a kind of thing where, as a politician, you can get easy applause by saying, well, we're going to give more money to the NHS and we're going to protect the NHS and keep it as it is. And conversely, it's very easy to attack your opponents by saying they want to give less money to the NHS and they're trying to sell it all off and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So that argument was almost guaranteed to be effective, but also quite difficult to rebut because the people who were trying to respond to it by saying, well, actually, that's not the right figure and the money would have to be used in this way and so on, they were already not trusted by the voters that this was meant to appeal to. And so, like, there was nothing that they could really do to counteract that other than engage with it on their own terms, which they just weren't really willing or able to do.
I guess I'm still just like, and I still have a ton more questions about all of the issues and what swayed people to vote one way or the other. But even now, I don't know, like, I have a good grasp on what's in it to leave. I don't feel like, what's the big upside in leaving? Is it not being codependent on the rest of Europe or what? Or feeling like your economy is going to tank hard if you don't leave now? Like, you'll take the small tank now and hope that it evens out in hopes of, foregoing an even bigger tank later by staying or what?
So the old school left-wing argument, which also mirrors the modern like center-right argument, did center around sovereignty. So we don't need an organization that doesn't have our best interests at heart and which is mostly going to be working in the interests of influential nations on the mainland or of multinational corporations and so on, making decisions on our behalf that we have to support and have to be committed to. And just in general, there's a desire to have our parliament make our laws and for the people who make decisions that affect us to be accountable to us. And I want to know that if someone does something I don't like, I at least have the possibility of voting them out at the next election, let's say. Whereas if there's some like aspect of European fiscal policy that I don't agree with, well, I can maybe vote out my MEP, but that doesn't even do anything because they don't have control over drafting the laws. And there are lots of unelected bureaucrats, as the phrase goes, who are making these decisions on our behalf, and it's easy to rile people up against that. The issue that defined this campaign, however, was immigration, and UKIP built their entire platform essentially on saying one of the big reasons to leave the EU is we currently have no control over our borders. We're having to let lots of low-skilled workers in who are competing over a much smaller pool of jobs, essentially. With people who are already having a tough time in the job market, they're driving wages down, they're using public services without paying in as much in order to reflect that. And that was a general gist of the argument. And so it was very easy for the more demagogic, if that's even a word, figures on that side of the case to just take that and run with it as far as they could and really stoke up a lot of resentment that ended up being targeted just at anyone who disagreed with that argument, regardless of who they were or what their position was or what they actually wanted to do.
Did you guys consider having Mexico build a wall for you?
Well, we have a moat. We have a pretty big moat, which is
True.
doing a decent job at the moment. Although not so much if you depending on who you ask. One of David Cameron's kind of political ruses, if you like, in the run-up to the campaign was he was going to go to Europe and renegotiate a deal which involved caps on migration and was essentially rebuffed by Angela Merkel, by other figures in the EU who took that off the table. And they gave him some limited victory in that regard that he could come back and try and sell as this big, as this great example of how he was able to have influence in the EU and get this arrangement that was really good for us. But no one actually believed that, least of all David Cameron. And the migration targets that he did set publicly, he failed to meet. And so it was trivially easy for Nigel Farage and others to say, look, he's made it very clear we don't have control over how many people are coming in. And for those of you who are my natural constituency, who I'm saying this to appeal to, that is one of the core arguments of their campaign. Now, as many people have pointed out, if he were to leave and have some kind of access arrangement of the type that Switzerland has had and the type that Norway has had, and those are the two examples that people often point to, they are still in the free trade area, the European Economic Agreement, and part of that is freedom of movement. So, in terms of people coming in from the EU, leaving the EU in the short term would not actually do much to stop that. You would need to either withdraw from that altogether, and then you'd have a whole new set of issues to deal with. And also, a lot of the immigration that these voters are most concerned about isn't even from the EU to begin with. It's from, third world countries, and you can imagine the arguments that get made there.
Well, what is at stake now? At now that you have left, and now that you're no longer going to be recognizing EU passports or whatever, what does that mean for like people that are not British citizens or British citizens that are outside of England?
Well, as I said before, it's going to be 2 years at minimum. Like, if they started negotiations and the formal process tomorrow, it would be at minimum 2 years before any
So
withdrawal was
nothing
made.
is the real answer. Nothing's going to happen right now.
Nothing's going to happen right now. And also, the people who are in the UK at the moment who are EU nationals, at least from the main Leave campaign, and this by itself was a fun issue where there were two like unofficial, there was like the official Leave campaign and the unofficial Leave campaign who were like fighting for supremacy of which was a true Leave campaign. which like was a depressing sideshow for a lot of us.
No, don't vote for leave. Write in leave. That's the way you got to leave.
Right. It's not the Judean People's Front. It's the People's Front of Judea. Yeah.
Right.
So I forgot the question now. Ask me again.
Well, no, I was just wondering about the actual like tangible results now that you have actually cast these votes, right, and the decision is final. When is that going to actually mean something for anyone?
Okay. So what I was about to say was the people who are in the UK at the moment, the EU nationals, the official stance from the official Leave campaign was the people who are here at the moment, they get to stay. So if the people who are upset about current levels of EU immigration, this isn't going to do much to fix them because those people are not going home. They're still going to be here.
So this is outright amnesty?
There might still be some like condition or visa arrangement or something. I'm not up to date on the technicalities of that. But my understanding...
Get up to date.
Well, so my understanding is those people would get to stay. I think politically it would be difficult to try and force them out, even if someone wanted to. The tricky thing would be, let's say you're someone living in Eastern Europe who wants to come to the UK, and you fear that in 2 years' time or 3 years' time, that's no longer going to be possible. Well, you're going to try everything you can to move there now, hoping that when that time comes, you're going to be protected by whatever grandfather clause or whatever ends up being introduced. And so in the short term, it could have the effect of actually increasing levels of immigration, which
right.
The people who are most upset about this are not going to take kindly to.
They should have thought that through a little better, I think. One other question, this from Ari, our good friend Ari on Twitter, or at Ari Ferrari. He said, I've seen many describe the exit campaign as xenophobic and racist. What kind of rhetoric was being spewed there? And this is obviously something that we may be seeing ourselves here in America in 2016.
Yeah, so the most iconic example, I guess, was there was a poster that Nigel Farage took great pleasure in standing in front of where the caption was, at breaking point or something like that. And it showed like a line of people trying to move past the gates, essentially, and come into the UK. And that was deemed by itself as just outright hostile to immigrants. And there were lots of other examples too. And there was a sense that even though certain specific things or specific people weren't directly targeting immigrants or being hostile to immigration, that they were kind of like tacitly going along with it or part of a political culture that was encouraging that. And so for instance, you had a lot of the more moderate, like center and center right Brexit campaigners who were uneasy about the tone of the campaign, who didn't really want to be in bed with Nigel Farage and UKIP in the first place, but who knew that without UKIP, there was no hope of them getting enough votes to win the referendum. And so they had to kind of let UKIP have a seat at the table. And what that meant was UKIP ended up dominating the discussion because they, you know, you see what Nigel Farage is like. He doesn't want to let anyone else get a word in edgeways. So it was kind of tough for them to, like, make an argument that wasn't tarred by association with everything else that they were saying.
Yeah. One just random question I had. I know you guys take your royal family quite seriously, as do we here in America. That's basically the only news we ever hear out of England is about the royal family. Did they have anything to say about this? Did they make an endorsement either way?
So there were rumors in the tabloids that the Queen was secretly campaigning for Brexit or whatever, which I very much doubt whether that was true. I think if any of the major figures in the royal family did take a public position, it would be seen as like a gross constitutional violation of their position. I mean, if like the Queen's inbred third cousin or whatever takes a stance, no one's really going to care. But if it's, you know, Prince Harry comes out in favor of Remain or something, then that would be seen as not really on. And I think it might be kind of productive in a sense because a lot of people would see that as like the unelected, you know, son of privilege or whatever trying to interfere with the election campaign.
How dare they see him that way, though? He's God's gift to England. He was his royal blood, Dom. How can you view it any other way? Do you guys buy, incidentally, just as far as how this voting, I'm curious about just how this voting ended up going down. Is this just one big nationwide popular vote, or is it town, district by district? Is there an electoral college or anything like that?
So the UK's general election system is first past the post based on constituencies. So what you have, and I think it's kind of a disingenuous argument, but you get a lot of people complaining that you have a government that's elected with less than a majority of the votes, where you can, like, let's say you can pile up votes in certain constituencies, but your representation in parliament is not going to be as high. And UKIP actually is a perfect example of this, where they received millions of votes at the last election, but they only had one seat in Parliament because those votes were distributed such that they were getting like third or fourth place in pretty much every constituency. And so in a proportional system, they might have had 10% of the seats or whatever. Whereas in actual fact, the way the system was built up, it causes this pyramid effect towards the two major parties. So that causes a lot of consternation. For this referendum,
is it kind of like in The Genius, potentially, where we see two sides form and then they each have one person who gets off to like a better start and they both need to like back that person at a certain point?
And you would see a lot of tactical voting. So Lib Dem voters would vote for Labour and vice versa just to keep the Tories out. You would see that quite a lot. So for this, however, it was just a straight up vote. So if more than 50% of the people supported one outcome, that was going to be the outcome. And that was just totaling all of the votes collected across the entire UK.
Okay, so one other thing that I've been meaning to go back to, I keep calling it England, you keep calling it the UK, and you pointed this out earlier as like an interesting distinction. Why is that an interesting distinction now? Or does it become more interesting or ironic or whatever after leaving the EU? What's the scoop on that?
Okay, so the history of Ireland and Northern Ireland and their relationship and their place in the UK is a whole other podcast by itself that I am not remotely qualified to talk about. However, what's relevant here is Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, voted by quite a decent margin to remain in the EU. And so there's a question now of, well, does the Parliament in Westminster still represent us properly, given that, you know, if they're trying to withdraw and we still want to remain, does it make more sense for us to break away to try and reform with the rest of Ireland, to try and go it alone? And it's especially relevant in the context of Scotland, where in 2014, they had a debate over independence, essentially. They had a secession referendum. And this has been a thorny issue in Scottish politics and therefore in UK politics for quite some time. And the Remain side, or the No side, won by a decent margin, so 55 to 45 in that case. But a big part of that was this understanding that, well, Scotland wants to remain in the EU, and now that the UK doesn't anymore, or at least that England doesn't, there's going to be a lot of temptation to say, well, that result no longer reflects the will of the Scottish people, and we need to have another referendum. And the leader of the Scottish Nationalists, who hold something like 90-95% of the seats in the Scottish Parliament at the moment, or at least of the seats for Scotland in Westminster, they have said, well, we just want to have another referendum as soon as is politically feasible, and it wouldn't surprise me if they got their way on that. And so there is this sense that, like, England is going one way, Scotland and Ireland are going another way. And this actually dates back to, I would say, the 1980s, where a lot of the Thatcher reforms were seen to be, if not explicitly targeting Scotland, then at least hitting Scotland the hardest. And the opposition to her was greatest form within Scotland. And so there's been like this, and so even at the last general election, the Conservative Party won in England by a decent margin, and they have done for quite some time, but they never win in Scotland. They're hated there. They rarely win in Wales and Northern Ireland and so forth. So there is a kind of natural political divide between the different constituent countries of the UK, and that feeds into the result here as well.
Is there some scenario where you leave, you take Scotland with you as part of the UK, but then Scotland wants to leave the UK and then goes back into the EU by itself or something along those lines?
So the trouble with that is, in order for a country to join the EU, it has to be unanimous among the current EU member states. And this was actually another deception during the campaign that people got very angry about, which was one of the immigration arguments that was made by Farage was, when Turkey joins the EU, we're going to have a lot of immigrants from Syria and other places coming to Turkey as their first port of call, and then they would have unfettered access to the EU. And people pointed out, well, no one actually wants to let Turkey in at the moment, so that just wouldn't be possible. But he kind of kept making that argument anyway. But the issue for Scotland is, like Spain, for instance, they don't want Catalonia to try and go for independence. And if they see that Scotland can declare independence and then come back to the EU, then that's going to support independence efforts in their own country. So they have an incentive to veto it. And you could easily imagine some like random other member state having some grievance that they want to air or get something like in return for membership and so on. So actually getting agreement for that would be a pretty tough pill to swallow. But to close on that, it could easily be that Scotland leaves regardless and tries to do that before The negotiations for the rest of the UK are complete. I don't know how that would work legally. I'm sure there's someone who can fill me in on that, but that could easily happen. And so if that's the case, David Cameron's legacy would be, after campaigning 2 years ago to keep Scotland in the Union, he would have pushed them away, and in the process, taken the UK out of the EU by accident. Like, keep in mind, David Cameron wanted a Remain win all along, and he called the referendum to deal with the tension in his own party over Europe, and also as a manifesto pledge, essentially, to win over floating voters who were maybe uneasy about the EU. And this pledge goes back some time. I think he only ever intended to call it if he knew he was going to win. And then when it became a manifesto pledge, he felt almost obligated to see that through because he would be punished for not delivering that. And then from the start, he believed that he was going to win, was pushing so hard for this result. And in the process, he just completely fucked it up. This is, there's some like debate among historians or whatever. This is being held as the biggest political blunder. You know, you can debate Iraq or Suez or whatever because there are, you know, military consequences of that. But in terms of just political miscalculation, this eclipses all of that. This is just the biggest single fuck up by a British prime minister that in living memory.
Just in sheer terms of unforced error. Like...
Yeah, it's. And keep in mind, he came off a general election victory last year, which no one really expected him to have. They thought it was going to be another hung parliament, maybe another coalition government. Instead, he wins an outright majority against a very poor opposition leader. That opposition leader is then replaced by an even less popular opposition leader who has, you know, strong support among the party faithful for Labour, but who doesn't really have a widespread following yet. And so the next election should have been an open goal. Like, this should have been a third easy consecutive term of Tory rule. Instead, now he has resigned. He's not going to be prime minister anymore. And he just scored an own goal into that open goal instead. It's it's amazing how he managed to fuck it up so badly.
Well, another question we got here from Gregory Jennings wanting to know, we know Scotland is potentially looking to flip here on the alliance. Is there a chance that Cameron here ends up breaking up all of the United Kingdom? Like, is Wales potentially thinking about going off on their own, or Ireland, Northern Ireland?
So Wales voted for Brexit, and there's a lot of anger among Remain supporters because Wales, compared to the rest of the UK, receives more money from like EU subsidies and so on. And so they see it as essentially Turkey's ready for Christmas and removing...
That's such a good analogy.
Have you not heard that idiom before?
No.
Well, that's a whole dictionary worth of British idioms that I can introduce you to. But
that's great.
So they see it as essentially the poorest voters in the country, many of them, being deluded into voting for an outcome which directly punishes them. And... so a lot of the
that tone... doesn't have any parallel here in America at all, Dom. I don't know. I don't feel like that's going to come into play.
So a lot of the tone of the analysis today is these people are also stupid and racist, and why can't they just fuck off and die already? And you know, so stuff to that effect. But yeah, that's a very realistic outcome, and in some ways, it might be better for all involved if the countries that feel that they are so distinct, like culturally and politically and economically from England, get to break away and have that kind of arrangement. And I guess the obvious argument that would raise is, well, if you can do that and still coexist peacefully with the UK with England in other ways, or with the rest of the UK, surely we can do that with Europe. And then the counter argument is, well, the EU is a much larger organization and so on.
Yeah, that's another question I have, because now that you guys have made your intentions known and have decided to leave, even with this like 2 year buffer period or whatever, you're still right near all of these European countries that you've just told you no longer want to be in a relationship with. What is going to be the fallout of that? And particularly with the EU countries, where are they going to want to now make an example out of you guys for saying, hey, you messed with the wrong organization? Like, make trade and stuff, et cetera, just as impossible as they can on you? Presumably, they're not like giant Nigel Farage fans.
Yeah, so that is a... so there's... you can find lots of YouTube clips of Nigel Farage in the European Parliament yelling at most of the senior EU figures, if you like. But yeah, so that's a very real possibility that, especially given fears over other countries following suit now, like Denmark has discussed leaving, there's some kind of movement towards it in the Netherlands as well. If they fear that other countries will try to follow our example, they might try to make an example out of us. And given how kind of obstructionist and petty and so on that the kind of EU machine can seem to be or be perceived to be at times, that wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was reading an article about this on 538 by Ben Castleman this morning. And he was, as you said, you're talking about some right-wing politicians in the Netherlands and also France, apparently already trying to float this, the idea of those countries leaving the EU as well. I feel like maybe you guys have poisoned the jury here, Dom. Do you guys feel like, are you guys the Laura Moret here of countries?
So does that mean we're going to come back again, right? And we have Redemption Island, so we get to come back again within that.
Your daughter's going to work out really well, potentially. We'll see. So I mean, she's out there right now. We'll find out.
I would clarify saying France, that there was no chance in hell of France leaving it. It's France is one of the most influential countries within the EU, and even among like the right wing, the mainstream right wing in France, there's basically no support for that. There is Marine Le Pen, the leader of the National Front, who is achieving what many people see as a disturbing level of support, and she is, you know, she is speaking of this outcome today as a victory. But one thing you have to understand is, as I said, the UK is by some margin the most Eurosceptic country in the EU, or formerly was. For most countries on the mainland, the idea of leaving the EU just seems so balmy and so not even in like the window of acceptable ideas, that to even voice the idea would get you demoted to the fringes of that country's politics. So you see this in not only France and Germany, which are like the two major bulwark countries, but other countries too, where you have like some support on the fringes. You have like some far left or far right party that supports leaving, but the vast majority of people in all of the major parties, and also the vast majority of voters who vote for those parties, are support staying in the EU, even if they disagree with specific policies, or even though they're like ideological equivalents in the UK and certain more Eurosceptic countries might support leaving.
So my biggest question, honestly, for you, Dom, is what does this mean for me? How is this going to impact my life? Is this going to come back into Maine in any kind of meaningful way? Or am I just going to, obviously, international, like economically, the dollar against the pound, that setting that aside, is this going to have any kind of blowback on me?
Well, so if you want to come to the UK and visit me, that's going to be a lot cheaper now. And that goes for any of you, by the way, just come over here and visit me.
Well, that's what that article I referenced, that's what it was talking about, is about how, hey, yeah, now the dollar is more valuable, but like it's bad news for the economy because American exports are, of course, thus going to be much more expensive over there.
Right. So imports, from our perspective, will be more expensive. Export, you know, the section of our economy that deals with exports will be better. So there's some kind of trade off there. But yeah, I mean, no one anticipated or really wanted a collapse in the pound to this degree. As I said, a lot of
I wanted it, but.
As I said, a lot of people also expect it to rebound fairly quickly within the coming weeks or months. So we'll see. I don't think anyone really understands how that's going to work yet, because, as I said, there's no real precedent for this. This is the first time a country of this size and stature has tried to pull out of an organization with this level of entrenchment, if you like.
I'm curious. We got a question from Sarah Freeman, good friend of the show, and also a British person. And she was asking, by how many years would the referendum have needed to be delayed to get a different result? Why is that an interesting question? Like, I guess that she's thinking it's, you know, younger voters were leaning more towards remaining. Is that the general idea or what? Or so, just the human progress would have gotten them there or what?
So I guess there's a question of, is it only political circumstances now that are making this a thing? And if you would have this debate, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, or in 5 years time, 10 years time, would you still get the same outcome? And I think like it took a fairly unique confluence of events for this to happen, and it had to be in one unique moment. And I think if you had done this 5 years ago, when this debate was maybe less acute, or in 5 or 10 years time, when a lot of the UKIP support had maybe died down a bit and the idea of the EU was less at the forefront of people's minds, then maybe you wouldn't get the same kind of outcome. And there's an interesting thought experiment, actually, of if you reheld the referendum tomorrow, would you actually get a remain vote, a leave vote still? Because one thing that the news is making a big deal out of at the moment is these marginal leave voters, or people who swung to leave at the last minute, or did it just to put their middle finger up at the establishment, who confronted with the reality now of leaving the EU and what that might mean, and you know they didn't necessarily expect it to happen, they just wanted to get their say in. Maybe they would swing back towards remain if if that was a thing. So that's a, I wouldn't say a fun discussion to have, but an interesting one maybe. And then I think it almost had to be now, because when Cameron made that initial promise of a referendum, either he was going to have to follow through with that or he wasn't. If he didn't, then I think UKIP would gain even more support, because a lot of people would feel lied to and betrayed. On the other hand, if he wasn't willing to give a referendum on that, you know, Labour certainly wouldn't have been. And there are lots of people within the Conservative Party who wouldn't have been either. And so the idea of that actually coming to pass in any way would just not be on the table at all. But to come back to your question, yeah, young people, if you want to call them that, so people in like the 18 to 29 and the 29 to 39 age group, voted overwhelmingly for Remain. I think it's something like 75% of 18 to 29s and 60-something percent of the next age group. And the only groups that broke solidly for Leave are, I think, like the over 50s and especially pensioners. And so one of the prevailing sentiments today is, I can't wait for all of these racist old people to die off so that we can have, you know, all of these enlightened young people who really ought to be running the country in charge making decisions again.
I mean, I feel like if you're open to it, Bernie Sanders, I know, is looking for an office to hold. If you need a new prime minister, I think we could send him over.
But he's also very old, right? So clearly he's a racist who needs to just pop his clogs already.
I don't know. I guess we could go either way. All right. One thing, and this is, as we're recording this, we've also been just getting more and more tweets coming in with questions. And one thing that I've just had a chance to just skim briefly, and I'm hoping you have as well, is again sent to us by Antonio Mazzaro, talking about the impact that Brexit is going to have on what we talk about in our other 225 podcasts or whatever, which is TV and just the media in general. Because, of course, especially like some of our favorite shows like Game of Thrones are filming all over the place now. And in looking at this, they're talking, you know, some of the major production that Michael Ryan here, the chairman of Independent Film and Television Alliance, was talking about producing films and TV programs is very expensive and very risky. As of today, we no longer know how our relationships will go with co-producers, financiers, and distributors. It's just too much up in the air, essentially. And I'm curious if maybe that is why some people were for remaining, if there was any kind of sentiment of we should remain just because we don't know what's going to happen if we leave. Was that a popular thought?
Yeah, that was one of the crucial arguments. And I think a big reason why so much industry support went to remain, even aside from any kind of like preferential treatment or whatever, it's we can't say for sure what the outcome is going to be. And we can say, oh, well, we can renegotiate this trade deal with this country and so on, but we don't know, like, we can't guarantee anything there. And so it's not like there's any one policy which is going to just completely knock us out. But given that we don't have that knowledge about what's going to happen, we can't make those kind of spending commitments and hiring commitments and so on and so forth that we need to function as an organization of our size in order to operate effectively. And so I think some of that, if they could be convinced that there was a solid blueprint for how any trade negotiation would work, maybe could have been swung in the other direction. But given that, you know, whatever their other grievances with the EU, the potential, however small it might be, for the industry to just completely detonate itself is so threatening that they just wanted the safe option there. Does this sound any better now? Or...
Yeah, so Dom, let's get into how you ultimately landed here. I know you did vote. I know the way you voted. But let's tell the people how you voted and what ultimately landed you on that side.
Okay, so I voted Leave, which is an unpopular decision, certainly among my Facebook friends, and I've been taking some amount of grief for that. And I imagine among the wider population and the people who are listening to this, and I'm happy to discuss that if people want to, but I think a lot of those arguments are kind of played out, so the only thing it can really accomplish is make both of us more riled up than we are already.
Well, it's because Dom is an old racist. That's why he left. That's why he wanted to leave. That's all it took.
Pretty much, yeah. But I'll get into the reasons why quickly. So one thing which, and I'll say at the start, like the overall approach of the Leave campaign and Nigel Farage and so on, every time they opened their mouths made me less and less likely to support Leave. And by the end, I was thinking like, do I really want to be associated with that? Even though I know for myself that, you know, my vote was independent of anything they were doing.
That's probably how many Michelle truthers felt this past Survivor season.
But the first argument, and I think whether or not this appeals to you, either consciously or subconsciously, is a fairly big determinant in how you view the EU and whether you're inclined to kind of have faith in it and give it the benefit of the doubt, is how much you believe big political organizations, and in this case, like very big supranational political organizations, can work effectively to solve problems. And in particular, I think if you look at the big kind of collective action problems that the EU has faced in recent years, so the Eurozone crisis, the migrant crisis, and so on, what you see is it's not a bunch of countries working together in harmony to achieve an outcome which is beneficial for all of them, but by themselves they couldn't have coordinated. It's the countries with more power and wealth and influence using all of those things to drive forward an outcome which is beneficial to them, often not beneficial to the countries that are forced to go along with it, and which is, I guess it's democratic in the sense that MEPs get to vote for it, but in the way that that is actually fed back to people in the member states, like there's no accountability there. And often the people making and enforcing these decisions are either failed politicians in their own states, or they're just people who are put in there to achieve a task. And, you know, as a voter, I can't fire them. I can't call them to account. And to the extent that I can do that with my domestic politicians, which is already very lacking, like I have an electoral system which doesn't fully weigh my vote. We have a House of Lords which is unelected, but which doesn't really have any power. And lots of people make the argument too about, well, because of the first-past-the-post system, our governments are elected with less than an outright majority, and so they don't really speak for the entire population. I would quibble with some of that, but the EU is deliberately and explicitly undemocratic. So you think back to when the Lisbon Treaty, which we kind of skipped over in our brief history of everything, was being passed in the 2000s. You had multiple countries who voted against the imposition of that in its early forms in referendums, and then were told to ignore that result and vote again, essentially, until they gave the outcome that the people in power and the people in power in the EU wanted them to give. And to me, it's like, well, if you have problems with the governments in your own country, then that's a problem that you have with the government in your own country, but you can at least have some hope of voting them out. If you have a problem with the direction of political influence in the EU, you have no hope of changing that. And as a member of the EU, you would still be affected by that and have to apply for it. And the argument that you hear in response is, well, as a member, you get some say in that, whereas if you leave, you don't. I think by even calling the referendum, David Cameron very stupidly conceded any influence that we would have in the future, because now the fact that we voted to remain, if we did, would be used as evidence that, well, clearly the weight of the great British public is behind whatever it is that we're trying to do, and the objections of your national government don't really enter the equation now. So I think that that influence that we had was hard to quantify as it is, and was going to be diminished even further by the result, whatever it ended up being.
Well, let me flag up what seemed to be, to bring it back to the John Oliver thing, and just from other people that I've heard talking about it, the fact that all of the like credible, air quote, credible resources or whatever were saying this is the blatantly incorrect thing to do, like the Bank of England and company. I don't know all of your like big financial places, Dom, I'm sorry. It seemed to be the overwhelming consensus was that they all thought that it would be the worst possible idea. How did you reconcile that with wanting to leave? Was it a case where you, as you flagged up earlier, thinking they said the same thing back in whatever it was, 2008, and we're way off base?
Partly. So you can say what you want about economics as a predictive science, and as someone who dropped economics as soon as I humanly could, I don't have too much to say about that. But yeah, like, so these are the same people who, to a man, to a woman, were lined up behind us joining the ERM back in the late 80s, who said that if we didn't join, then we couldn't be fully integrated into the EU, and that there would be, you know, the pound would collapse, there would be disaster befalling us. And then disaster did befall us because we had joined, and we were forced out in one of the most costly and humiliating episodes politically and economically in our history. And then when the Euro debate came around in the late 90s, early 2000s, all of those same people, once again, were making the same arguments for joining the Euro. And
that's what I was talking about. Sorry, yeah, 2008, sorry.
Yeah, yeah. And so having seen how the Eurozone has developed in the time since then, you look at the Eurozone crisis with Greece and so on, I don't think that we would be better off had we joined the Euro. And none of those people now are making the argument that we would be. And there's no mainstream support in the UK for joining the Euro now. And I fear that, you know, those people are experts in their fields, and I don't wish to deny them that. But to the extent that their expertise comes into play on this question. It's their expertise is in being wrong on the impact of British economic decisions as it pertains to Europe. So, you know, I give some weight to that, but I'm not inclined to trust it. And also, you know, a lot of those individual figures weigh in domestic political debates, and there are the usual kind of questions about how much you trust them in those cases and so on. So it was a factor for me, but not nearly as big as I think most people would want it to be.
How much of just as being an observer and potentially someone who fell victim to it yourself, Dom, how much of what Pia again wrote in asking and described as the Trumpification of politics came into play here for you as far as wanting to like rally against the man?
So I won't lie. There was a lot of satisfaction in seeing David Cameron, who I have a lot of personal distaste for, be forced to fall on his sword this morning. That wasn't the impetus behind it, but I think like the burning desire that a lot of people had to stick it to the establishment, this outcome, I think, is not going to achieve a lot of what those people wanted. Maybe this outcome forces their voices to be recognized in some degree, but I think like they're in that situation, and it's easy to like mock them or call them stupid or say that you hate them for ruining the country. But the fact that they felt they were in a position to do that, they're not feeling successful at the moment. Like they're not kind of reveling in their success and trying to just kick the people below them. They feel that there's something deeply wrong with their situation, and a lot of that is being directed at people who are blameless. So just migrants who are coming over trying to do the best for themselves and who are in the same situation as a lot of them are. But I think politically there's just no desire to even acknowledge that as a problem. Like you see it now, everyone's saying, okay, we have to be more mindful of their concerns, but no one actually is willing to say engage with the immigration debate in a way that would harm their own political support in order to do that. And I think until that happens, like you're never going to fully satisfy them. And the next time they have a chance to voice that anger against a political party or any other kind of institution, they will do it. And I don't know what form that will take. But more broadly speaking, I think, and especially in a two-party system where you have one party that's like a broad umbrella representing right-wing thought and then left-wing thought, like within Labour at the moment, and you see this a lot, both I think in the US with the Democrats and also in mainland Europe as well, I think a lot of that old like working class left-wing support just doesn't really have a home anymore. And so it's, as I said, it's easy for other groups who maybe wouldn't have as much traction otherwise to move in and grab that. I think it's just an issue of like the people who are in power and who rise to power within those groups just can't, within those parties, can't really empathize with it or understand it or and don't want to make concessions to it. And I'm not saying they should necessarily, it's just that's a situation, and I don't see it really changing in the short term itself.
Do you feel like this is something where after we have whatever it takes, 8 years, 12 years, 20 years of seeing how all of this plays out, assuming it does play out, assuming that, you know, Parliament doesn't overturn this in some like historically unprecedented situation, assuming you guys do go through with and leave the EU, are you going to be able to definitively say in however much time, okay, we definitely made the right decision or the wrong decision, or is it just going to get argued to death either way, depending on how things go?
I don't think so. I mean, I guess if the economy does collapse massively and we enter into a deep recession, then there'll be a lot of temptation to say we just made the wrong decision straight up. But then, as anyone who has listened to us will know, we would want to say, well, based on the information we had at the time, was that credible to think? Was that a guaranteed outcome or just one which happened in the actual timeline and so on? And if it ends up being like a marginal failure or a marginal success, it's going to be hard to even acknowledge that as a result of leaving the EU or staying in the EU in the counterfactual case. 12 years ago, if we had voted to stay in the EU, then now this small thing would be different. And therefore this other small thing, you know, I don't see how you can credibly make those kind of statements.
Well, Dom, I would imagine that, you know, this whole Brexit debate is probably not going anywhere anytime soon, and you're going to probably have to spend a long time defending yourself. What other points are you hoping people can keep in mind as this discussion, for however long it ends up happening, continues?
So the other big thing that swung it for me is the situation that we had before we left, like the status quo, if you like, it wasn't all that bad in the grand scheme of things, but it was the best that we were realistically going to get. And it was a fairly unusual situation where a lot of stuff had been granted to us because we were so obstinate about not wanting to fully commit in the past. And so there were lots of these random opt-outs and concessions and so on that had been given to us weren't really given to many other countries in the EU, and which no one really wanted to give us in the first place, but it was always understood that, like, well, we have to keep the British happy, so we'll throw them a bone, and hopefully that's going to be good enough.
Has anyone ever kept the British happy?
I don't think so. I'm certainly not happy, so I can only speak for myself, though. So that situation was fine, and if that was what was on the table, then it would have been a closer decision for me. But the vote isn't between leaving and just staying as we are in our fairly unique position. It's leaving and staying in for the next, you know, 40 or 50 years potentially before this question might come up again, and thinking about what is our relationship with the EU going to look like over that time. And a lot of senior EU figures have expressly said they want to continue this move for greater political integration, economic integration, and, you know, in foreign policy integration and so on. And so with the euro, for instance, we've been able to keep the pound. That's not sustainable in the long term. If you want to have a common fiscal policy, you need all of the members in your economic union to be signed up to the same single currency. And I think there's a lot to be gained from having control of our own currency. Like the issue that we've seen with Greece, as an extreme example, is when you have a bunch of countries with very different economic situations and incentives all being bundled up together and forced to act in the same way, then that's not going to be good for a lot of those, and it's going to stretch some of them to breaking point. And when that happens, you're relying on the goodwill of other European countries to bail them out, and that's not going to be a free thing. They're going to want other things in return for that. And so you're playing games with the most fundamental part of your economy, which is your currency, where you're relying on these other, like, political outcomes aligning in the right way in order for that to be sustainable. So, for instance, I think we would have to probably give up the euro in the long term. That's not a sacrifice I would want to make. Likewise, on foreign policy, you think back to the heated debates over the Iraq war back in 2003-2004. We had a million people marching in Hyde Park on the basis that we were lied to, we are being lied to, we don't want our government to take us to war. And when they did that, obviously they were outraged that's what was happening, but they knew at the next election they could go to the ballot box and vote out the people who did that. Now, it turns out they didn't, but that's a topic for another time. if we have a common foreign policy, and Juncker's talking about a European army, we're not going to get to make that call. And we could find ourselves, you know, having troops committed to a foreign conflict that we, in principle, don't agree with and which we can't hold them accountable for. And that, I think, for the people who talk about, you know, the illegality of war and being concerned about that, that is something that I think should weigh heavily on their minds.
So is this England, or the UK, excuse me, potentially making a statement, almost declaring itself like a libertarian country, saying we'll take care of ourselves and we don't need to be in on all of your collective stuff, we've got it figured out? Is that accurate or inaccurate in your mind?
So I think there's another tension there, because you have some people who say, we're going to be totally self-sufficient and Europe can go screw itself. And that's the Farageist approach, if you like. And then you have the kind of like more moderate wing saying, well, we want to be in Europe. Like, geographically, we are in Europe as a matter of international cooperation. We want to be in Europe, but that doesn't mean we have to be in a political body that does a lot of things that we don't agree with and which seems to be lacking in certain ways. And so if those people have control over the debate, which I think they will, then I think they're going to work towards an outcome which broadly resembles what we have now, or what we had now, but without a lot of the shackles that were imposed. Now, the argument that you would hear from the Remain side for that is, well, a lot of the stuff that we have now is only there because we are in the EU, and outside of the EU, we wouldn't be able to get that, even if other countries were on board with it, which in some cases they wouldn't be.
So for you, it essentially came down to, first, I don't necessarily buy this doomsday scenario that all of these alleged experts are painting. And second, I feel like this is going to be the last opportunity to potentially be able to get out of the EU within a reasonable amount of time. And I'm liking the direction that it's going at this, the pace that we're on.
Right. And in terms of the economic points, again, a lot of our trade is with the EU, but I think it's kind of disingenuous, because that's given the fact that we are in the EU and that therefore we comply with these regulations and that these are our most natural trading partners. Whereas if we left, we would still have to and want to trade with them to a large degree. We would have a lot more freedom to negotiate agreements with other countries and do that in a bilateral way. And that would take time to work through. And I don't claim to know most of the details of that. And it would be some time before we actually knew what that would look like. But I think that ability to be more flexible in how we interact with other countries economically would be a boon both to us and to them. And you can look at this from the EU's side as well, where we have always been like an uneasy partner for them. And if they are on this move towards integration, if the countries involved genuinely want that, as it seems like most of the countries in the EU do, then you know, fair enough, good for them, and they can work towards doing that. If they have us hovering on the periphery, needing them to keep up this two-track system just to accommodate us, well, that doesn't help them, and it might help us in some ways, but it harms us in others. And so whatever the recriminations that you hear now from Schäuble in Germany, and I'm butchering his name horribly, I'm sure, about how there are going to be no concessions to the UK and so on, I think there's more room for friendly cooperation when those countries no longer have to accommodate us, and when they can move ahead with a more agreed upon game plan, and they don't have to pander to us in the process.
Well,
we could engage as like rational, independent adults, and not feel that we were just doing it out of like a sense of obligation.
Well, we talk about though on all these reality shows that we talk about all the time, saying like it'd be great if Kat Ederson could just approach this situation like a rational adult. Right. Like, doesn't it seem at least a bit optimistic that Germany, of all countries in particular, is just going to forgive and forget? Does that sound like Germany, Dom?
Well, I'm sure they would bring up like the Treaty of Versailles or whatever, but yeah. So what I would say to that is, if you seriously think that in the event of Brexit, that countries would act in like this spiteful way, even though it goes against their own economic interest, just to get one over on us for leaving, that doesn't sound like the type of partner that you want to have in a long-term political, fiscal, and so on union, where you're going to have to be accommodating their interests on a day-to-day basis with every single decision that you make, and where you have not only one of those countries for any given case, but you know, 26 other countries who all have their own vastly different incentives, different priorities, and so on. And I think trying to reconcile all of those, you end up with these very messy compromises that don't actually achieve anything more than like the absolute minimum that could be agreed.
Well, I think, at least for me, as someone in America, not, you know, we're basically on our own. We have Canada and Mexico on either side of us. But it's not like we have all these other countries that we have to deal with constantly, isn't like close geographically. It seems to me like, yeah, sure, you can be in this kind of marriage of convenience with Germany and then get a divorce. But when you get divorced in real life, like one of you can move to Florida, whereas you're still going to be in near all of these European countries that you've just told essentially to fuck off.
Well, it would be a messy divorce, probably, and there's no disguising that. However, we could also, you know, now that we're newly single and on the dating market, maybe we hook up with, you know, Australia and New Zealand. Maybe we reach out to America and Canada and get to know them a bit better. Like, there are lots of other options out there in the world. And there are so many countries out there who they don't feel that their national identity or their economic prospects are lacking because they're not part of some faraway European political union. Like, that's, you know, they are able to be perfectly self-sufficient outside of that. And we are currently the sixth largest economy, but stay tuned, maybe we'll be the 12th by the time we get to bed and this goes up. I think we have a lot of clout. That's not going to change, and we can use that more effectively if we have more control over how we decide to use it. And so that's what it boils down to, at least on that point.
Okay, I think that definitely does make sense. I would have some concerns about Germany still, Dom. That's all I'm trying to say.
Well, we'll always be side-eyeing them. Yeah. But no, you could invite a Remain supporter onto here, and we could have like a hour long, you know, however many hour long debate about the merits of all of this and the ins and outs and so forth. But I don't want to say the debate's over because there's so much still to come now. But it's like, in terms of the sheer political question, that's now being settled, and now the question is, how are we going to accommodate that new reality? And I think what we need now is the people who were working for Remain to be on board with that, because if the debate does become dominated by Farage, that's going to be a tragedy. And if it is purely dominated by like the people who are working for Brexit, then that's not good either. Like, you need people who I think can provide that balance and moderation to get any kind of decent deal going. Understandably, I think, given that they support this so wholeheartedly, a lot of the tone today is like, well, fuck the other side, I can't believe this is happening, I want to leave the UK and move to Canada, which I can perfectly understand, but I can guarantee they're not going to do that. But I think in the long term, there does need to be some kind of like if not reconciliation, then at least understanding that, okay, we disagree with your decision. We still think you made a massive mistake in doing that. Given that this is happening, this is what we want out of it, and this is how we're going to work towards it. Because otherwise, it's just not going to work for anybody.
Before we get out of here, I want to at least find out about the darkest timeline. Is it you guys hit like some kind of crucial recession? Well, Boris Johnson, who I can't believe hasn't come up yet, but he seems like a real fun guy. He's the one who, from what I've seen, has been compared as like the Donald Trump of this whole endeavor. For the people who watch the John Oliver one, he's the guy who looks like the adult Dennis the Menace. Dom, do you know?
Yes.
And tell us about it. He was the former mayor of London. I know that, and now it looks like he may be the person who takes the new prime minister spot.
And even that, the fact that Boris Johnson was in charge of one of the world's largest and most important cities is kind of baffling to me.
Largest.
But sure. So imagine if like Trump was actually a classic scholar and you have Boris, basically. Like, if Boris is Trump if Trump was secretly very intelligent and Machiavellian, whereas I think Trump is an opportunist, certainly, but he's just doing whatever he feels like on any given day. I think Boris is a lot more calculated than that, and he comes across as a buffoon, and he's carefully cultivated that image where he can basically say and do anything he wants, and people say, oh shucks, that's just Boris, you know, being Boris. And but secretly behind the veneer, he is, I don't know what he actually believes, and I don't think anyone really knows what he believes, so he's kind of similar to Trump in that regard.
Yeah.
And I think he definitely has that lust for power, and he will say and do what he needs to win. Now, when he has had to expose his beliefs, they have been more moderate than the more extreme wings of the party. So there's some consolation there for some people. But Boris is an unknown quantity. And if you were scared about, you know, the uncertainty of a Brexit vote, the uncertainty of Boris Johnson being in charge of the UK is on a whole different scale.
Yeah, if I could offer some constructive criticism for the producers of Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. This episode aired like 2 days before this vote happened. Like, they try to send these critically important messages. They did the same thing with the president who just got elected in the Philippines, who's also been compared to even like a worse version of Trump, who's like openly telling people to murder any like drug dealers they see or whatever. Like, he talks about murdering people himself and things like that. And like, the producers have these stories air 2 days before the vote is in question. Like, there's no time to rally anyone when you do it that close to the actual event.
Well, also, it turns out that, you know, people don't take kindly to people from other countries butting in and telling them how to vote. Like, Obama is very, very popular over here. Like, when he was first elected, he was a rock star. He was a celebrity. And I remember being in high school at the time. I don't think there was literally a single person I could find who didn't actively support Obama and want him to win. And that was reflected among the wider country. Even most conservatives were rooting for Obama. But when he came out and said, well, Brexit would be a disaster, I think most people just kind of ignored him. And likewise, you know, when John Oliver, who is a Brit himself, I will grant, comes out and says, well, you're stupid if you don't vote for Remain. Like, that is not seen as something that they need to listen to. Like, that's just one more voice in the whirlwind. It reminds me of when one of the newspapers here, The Guardian, in the 2004 presidential election in the US, they had British people write to American voters to convince them to vote for John Kerry. And you can imagine how well that worked out, which is basically not at all. And most people just told them where to go. So
fuck off, Nigel. Yeah,
I don't think that really was going to do anything, even if it was many weeks prior.
Well, the ultimate question for this podcast, Dom, he's come up many, many times, but I got to know, I want to hear you explain it at least. Why do you hate John Oliver so much? He might be literally the most popular person in America right now.
Well, see, that's why. Okay, so he is muscling in on my territory of just saying the blatantly obvious and getting it lauded as some amazing insight because you have a British accent. And that's that's what I do, okay? And now he's doing that and is more successful at it than I am. Like, he has a, you know, multi-million-dollar television enterprise or whatever. And I'm not really a fan of that kind of political humor in general, because I find if you try to engaged with the facts that are behind it, they can just say, oh, well, it's a joke, it's meant as comedy, why are you taking it so seriously? And then if you get offended by it, they say, well, it was just comedy, why are you taking it so seriously? So it's like they're trying to have their cake and eat it too, where they want you to feel that this is the new medium of political communication, but they don't actually want to engage with it in any real way.
Right, I totally agree. Like, while Jon Stewart was right to go on Crossfire in 2004 and tell them that what they were doing was like completely hacky and should not be televised, they are also right in saying that what Jon Stewart did and what John Oliver currently does, they are completely free rolling. They can always use the defense of, oh, I'm a comedian, no one should listen to me, no one should take me seriously, but they are blatantly trying to preach every single episode. That's what all they're trying to do.
And the philosophy behind the comedy on a lot of these shows is we're going to bond together and laugh over how stupid the people who don't resemble us are. And like the way that they do that is instead of actually listing positions on issues in detail, what they do is they give you like this 5-minute canned summary that's peppered with jokes and clips and like laugh tracks or whatever. And like if you actually want to know about nuclear proliferation or whatever, go and read like an 80-page dossier or whatever that's published by some defense organization. Don't share this 5-minute John Oliver clip that you found on Reddit and expect that all of your Facebook friends are gonna praise your good judgment and your wisdom and insight.
But I'll get so many upvotes.
You will. Yeah, it's worth noting actually, because you mentioned London, and that's a very important thing that I kind of forgot to touch on earlier. And just as a last serious point, there is a very stark divide between London and the rest of the country. And it kind of mirrors the divide between England and the other countries in the UK, where London, like living in London may as well be a completely different experience, like socially, economically, and so on, from living almost anywhere else. Where London, like in most countries, you have the capital city, you have the city that's known for like its cultural exports and stuff. You have the center of political power, you have the financial center and so on. London is all of those things. Like any aspect of national life and identity that you think is important is going to be based and centered in London in some way. And so
Hogwarts?
That creates this...
Is Hogwarts in London?
I don't think Hogwarts has a fixed like spatiotemporal location, but anyway. So the issue is anyone who wants to be anything, in quotation marks, moves to London, wants to live in London, or even if they don't want to live in London, they feel the need to move to London because that's where all the action is happening. And so London is, like the UK is already very expensive to live in, even in some of the less desirable parts. But London especially is one of the most expensive places to live in the world, like up there with Sydney, New York, and
and
other places. And there's there's perceived to be a shortage of housing, and people find it hard to like find good jobs there, ones that are stable and pay well and so on. And so you have people like living in these suburbs an hour and a half's commute away from London because that's the nearest place that they can afford. And you know, that's a sacrifice that they need to make to remain part of like London's orbit.
It's cheaper than living in London is commuting an hour and a half every day. It's amazing.
Right. Like I live near Bristol, which is maybe 2 hours drive away from London. And there's been a lot of displacement from London to Bristol because like London just can't contain that many people anymore, so some of them have to move elsewhere, and this is the cheapest or most desirable place. It is still close to London.
Yeah.
And so you see like house prices in Bristol moving up now as well, so it's like, so London is the center of gravity, if you like, the center of mass of the UK, and it like sucks in everything around it. And so what you have is these areas 5 hours away from London up north where they don't really, like no one really pays attention to them politically. There's no political drive to invest more in those places or to just care about the concerns of people in those places. And a lot of the jobs that you find there, if you can even find them, are pretty insecure. Like they're either 0 hours contracts where you find out on the day what hours you're working, where you're working them, where a lot of them were former like manufacturing towns where in the 80s, one of the most controversial things about the Thatcher government was she withdrew a lot of the state subsidies for mining and for other industries, and the industries that weren't able to be competitive outside of that just withered away and died. And so what you had was a lot of late 30s, middle-aged men who used to work in industry and see that as a dependable career that they could spend their life doing, who are now thrust onto the job market, who maybe didn't have a university education, who didn't have any skills other than ones that were just rendered obsolete, and they're now having to compete for this kind of tight package of low-wage jobs with people coming over from Poland, let's say, who are perfectly willing to work for less than minimum wage and to not unionize and to not, you know. And so it's for these companies who are just looking to slash costs, it's much easier for them to employ this supply of cheap labor than it is to to employ people who actually used to live there for a long time. And so this is the argument as they see it. And so
we've gone through very similar things here. I'm sure it's right. Bringing a lot of bells close to home here.
Right. And so like when they hear like some guy who works in an economics foundation on like on a London-based media outlet say, oh, well, immigration's contributes X point Y percent to the economy in GDP this year and so on. Like what they hear is, okay, that's great. And it's, I still want those doctors and engineers and everything to come over here. But my experience of this is these people coming over and, fair play to them because they're just doing what they have to do. But they're forcing me out and now I have nowhere left to go. And so they feel that they're not being listened to. And while I think a lot of people are trying to make gestures about listening to them now, until they actually feel that they're being represented, and I have no idea what that would possibly take, then that's going to be like we're going to have uprisings in popular sentiment like this for a long time, I think. And you see that, as you said, with Trump in the US, where even the people who are turned off by Trump and who really don't like him or trust him think, well, what else are we going to do, right? Like it's I don't expect Trump to solve my problems, but nothing else is solving my problems, so let's just take a chance, and I don't care if everything else goes up in flames alongside that.
Well, is that how you feel, though? I guess
how I feel, because I'm not in that situation. But if I had been born in like a Yorkshire mining town, and I was like maybe I would feel that way. I don't know, but it's easy for me to say this is good for the country in these ways, because if it does turn out to be bad, I'm not going to be the one affected by it. So I can make whatever statements I want and believe them and sincerely believe them. But I'm kind of insulated from like the worst effects of that if it turns out to be wrong. So.
Yeah, I mean, I really should take a much more vested interest in like foreign politics, just because I can wax poetic all day about that, and it's not going to impact me at all. That could be great.
Well, so I can say whatever I want about the U.S. elections and how stupid people are for voting for Trump, because like, well, what are they going to do to me? Like, are they going to burn me in effigy? Well, good luck crossing the Atlantic Ocean, right?
Yeah. While we're here talking not about TV and reality TV, setting Brexit aside just quickly, let's get your projection on June 24th, 2016. What is the margin between Hillary and Donald Trump going to be in the popular vote?
Oh, wow. Okay, so whatever answer I want to give is going to be tempered by the fact that I said like 2 days ago the margin for Remain was going to be like 4 points or whatever, and now it's 4 points in the other direction. So,
This is with a lot up in the air still. I know there's still plenty of talk. There's still third party candidates potentially coming into play. I still think it's going to come down to ultimately just the two of them. I'm planting my flag early. I think Hillary Clinton gets at least 55% of the vote. I think there are going to be so many Republicans who just stay home.
See, I want to say that. And I want to say that Trump's support is capped at the people he's already acquired and is about to acquire.
Right.
But then you would say that after any of the primary contests, after he actually won the nomination, when it seemed like no one would support him. And instead, every single Republican just came with their tail between their legs, crawling up to Trump to kowtow before
it was insane. It would be like, okay, oh, Jeb dropped out. That's going to be a huge boost for Rubio and Cruz. And then it was Trump who would go up even higher.
Right. And it's so weird to see like all of Trump's former enemies just endorsing him, where it's got to be so liberating to be Trump, where you can say literally whatever you want. You can insult whoever you please, and they will just support you anyway. It's like, it's like when you can see the fact that you need to win over people in the middle, you're now just working with the people who are always going to support you anyway. And so you can just insult them directly and they will still vote for you. Like you can just do whatever you want.
It's amazing.
So watching Rubio be tortured in public over whether he should support Trump after Trump was like belittling everything about him, it's so bizarre to watch. Like it's like all the normal rules of decorum are just completely out the window. Because however bad you think this Brexit debate has been, and it's been pretty bad at times, and I would say on both sides, but more so on the Leave side, like it is nothing compared to what Trump single-handedly almost has done to just the tone of debate. Because even when you have politicians who are just so off the reservation and would be automatic zeros in any other country, even they like feel some need to play within the rule book, right? Where it's like George W. Bush can lie about McCain having an interracial child, but when he gets to the debates, he's going to be all chummy and shake his hand and so on and so forth. Trump is just going to people's faces and be like, I fucking hate you. You're an idiot. You're a failure. And bow down and support me now, because it's only a matter of time. And I almost wish I had what he had, but in a way where I'm not just going to like destroy the world if it ends up being powerful. Right?
I really think the most fun for me has been watching people like you mentioned, like Rubio or like Paul Ryan, kind of straddle the fence on endorsing and not really being committal about Trump and not wanting to do too much. Because I think they can see that this is not going to ultimately go his way, and they have clear aspirations for 2020 and 2024. So that's my favorite game, is hearing the people who want to be on the right side of history 4 years from now, but also want to look like they're being team players now. That's always a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, can I also say that all these ex-Bernie people who are voting for Trump, I can understand not liking Hillary or not wanting to vote for Hillary and saying, like, in order to earn my vote, you have to cross this, like, minimum threshold, and Hillary doesn't do that for me. I can understand that argument. If you're saying, I used to support Bernie and now I'm supporting Trump, that doesn't make any sense.
Like, what you're saying is I am not an informed voter, if that's what you're saying. You're saying I vote with my heart.
Like, if your argument literally is, I'm going to vote for the least popular conventional candidate in each party, well, that's fine, but you understand that they are in different parties, right? Like, there is a reason that Bernie and Trump are not together in cahoots already, and it's because they completely fundamentally disagree, both personality-wise and policy-wise, over literally everything.
Yeah.
So it's just...
Yeah, I really feel like I'm planting my flag here early. Now that I never like to bring this kind of stuff up when we're talking about reality TV, but when we're talking about politics anyway, like, Trump has absolutely no shot. There is no way this is going his way. There is absolutely none.
I think a lot of this stuff about Hillary, like some scandal or her getting indicted or whatever, I think that's wishful thinking on the part of people who want that to be true. And even if there is like some scandal, you need it to come out before the election, have it be big enough that it would torpedo her chances, and for that to like percolate in a relevant way. And I just don't see that happening.
Yeah, I should clarify, if it's him against Hillary, obviously if she gets indicted, that completely changes things. But assuming it is the two of them facing off
Like, you can imagine, Trump is going to have found every possible true criticism and a whole lot of untrue criticisms that can be leveled at Hillary. And if those involved her actually being taken down in some corruption scandal, that would pretty much be out there right now. Or it would come out there, I guess, after the convention, maybe. But there's no indication that that's true. And so, I think Hillary's going to win. I think she's going to win by a decent margin. It's weird because, like, I imagine there are some states which are going to be very solidly for Trump, but then I don't think Hillary has a shot of doing like the Reagan or Nixon thing where she just gets 49 states or whatever. Does she get higher than Obama in 2008, do you say?
Yes.
Or
yeah.
I would have to guess so. Like, what do you think the cap is for Hillary here?
I don't know about the cap, but I honestly think like the baseline for Trump, and I guess thus the cap for Hillary, she's not like, no one's, I don't think, ever going to get 60% again of the popular vote. Like Reagan won 49 out of 50 states against Mondale. And FDR, I think, also won 49 out of 50 states in one of his elections. It's certainly not going to be anything close to that. I don't think we're ever going to see anything close to that. Maybe that's too bold of a call to say we'll never see anything close to that. I think it's still going to be relatively close, but I think Hillary could easily be looking at like 57, 58%. It would not surprise me.
I wonder if the people who just can never stomach voting for Trump but also don't want to vote for Hillary, do they stay home? Do they just suck it up and vote for Hillary anyway? Do they vote for some third party candidate? Like, what do you think they do?
Well, that's why I'm going so high, is I feel like there are going to be a lot of people just not wanting to get off the couch to go vote for Donald Trump. So I think there is going to be just a lot of people holding out that would have voted for that probably would have happily gone and voted for Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio.
Yeah, I believe logistically it's not absolutely too late, but it's pretty much too late for a third party candidate who isn't already in to join the fray, just because of ballot access reasons and so on. But you have like Gary Johnson in, you have Jill Stein, I imagine, is running again. So do they pick up disaffected would be Bernie supporters or like would be Rubio supporters? Like, where do you think that goes, or do they just stay home?
I could see, again, the reason I'm so high on Hillary is I see a lot of people just staying home, but I do think there is a pretty, I don't know, both sides have like really strong bases, I would say. There are a lot of people who feel really strongly for Trump and really strongly for Hillary.
Yeah.
And I think much more so than any election that I can recall, there are a lot of people who are thinking, I don't want to vote for either of these people.
Well, also, I think a lot of people who not only do they feel very strongly for Hillary or for Trump, but I think holding that position means you're going to be very heavily anti whoever the other person is. So you have like a twofold incentive to get out there and cast your vote. Yeah. And it's like, even if you're maybe lukewarm about Trump, you might really not like Hillary or vice versa. And so just to like avoid the worst case scenario, you might want to go out there and make a statement.
Yeah. I kind of feel, do you wonder about going back to Brexit? Do you feel like this is something that when, you know, 40 years from now, when you're a senator or whatever, when you're a member of parliament yourself, Dom, is it going to be looked back upon you? Hey, this guy voted for leave instead of stay. Is that going to be looked upon as a negative? The same way that I could see politicians down the line, like we were talking about, being looked upon negatively for supporting Trump during right now.
I can imagine that being like a decisive political issue in almost the same way that casting your vote for or against Iraq was. Maybe not to the same degree, but like in terms of, I don't know anything about these candidates, I need a benchmark to judge them on. My position on Iraq then or Europe now, that's going to be a deciding factor. And if you voted the wrong way, as I see it, then you will need a pretty amazing argument in the other way to convince me. And I think a lot of people will feel like that. I think, like, yeah, I can easily imagine in 10, 15 years' time, we think, why the hell did we vote for Brexit? And there are some people thinking that already, apparently. It's, as we said, it's hard to weigh up, like, what would have happened if we stayed? Because, like, my argument for leaving, which is not one that I see many people making, was, again, it's not a choice about the status quo. It's the counterfactual EU that we would have had 10 years down the line, which, like,
right. It's
very difficult to conjure up in people's imaginations, right? Like, it's not an open and shut thing of, well, we could have had this and now we don't.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it goes back to what we always talk about as we're talking about decision making in these reality games, is just doing the best that you can with the information that you have at the time.
Right. So what else, now that we're just, I think anyone who is greatly offended by our hot take so far has already long since tuned out. So is there anything else that we want to get on the table now that we're here and now that we're talking about actual serious issues for the first time in ever?
I don't know, but this was really fun. We should definitely at least leave the door open for doing this again sometime.
If there's some like demand for it, then sure.
I'm all Brexited out. I've had a full Brexit.
I do intend on podcasting about the West Wing at some point during this off season. But by the way, if you want to be a part of that, then get in touch, because I need someone to talk about it to, given that Colin has not finished it yet. But I imagine there are going to be a lot of parallels between what we see in there and like the kind of wish fulfillment fantasy, if you like, that show represented at times, and the kind of reality that we see unfolding and collapsing, you might argue, all around us.
If
now.
You think for one second that Aaron Sorkin would not have been the most pro-Remain person,
oh,
it wouldn't have been
sure.
the most bleeding heart Remainer that existed.
Like I can already imagine like the newsroom episode writing itself, right? Like
He literally created the newsroom so that he could comment on international issues because the West Wing was not good enough, just waxing philosophical about domestic policy.
And also commenting on current issues, right? Like the whole approach of the show is, this is something that happened recently. This is how, with the benefit of hindsight, you certainly should have done it at the time. And why you're stupid for not doing that.
Right, exactly.
And here's a hot take for you. Do you think that Aaron Sorkin and his style of like political discourse almost, I want to say, like, help to set the stage for a lot of the stuff that we're seeing now in the other direction, where you have this example of what politics could be, like this shining beacon,
and instead
contrasted with how it is in reality.
So instead we get Veep, where it's the opposite extreme, where everyone's just freaking out in a mess and can't do their job and swearing at each other.
You get Veep, you get the thick of it, you get House of Cards, you know, and
right,
so on.
Right. Yeah, I think that's actually an interesting point. I don't know. Maybe ER needed to exist for Scrubs to ever exist. Like, you have to do it the first way for it to then get the kind of like parody of the original.
Well, more directly, do you think it set up a lot of the like political comedy or talk shows that we're seeing nowadays, where like John Oliver to me is a spiritual successor to Aaron Sorkin in that style of presentation, where you can imagine a John Oliver skit being quite easily readapted to be like a Josh Lyman, Toby Ziegler walk and talk, right?
Yeah. That's really good. I mean, you could literally see, instead of the newsroom, the next Aaron Sorkin show is going to be, the protagonist is whoever the John Oliver, John Stewart equivalent is of that fictitious
yes.
world.
Yes.
That's the show. That's what it's going to be.
I'm kind of surprised that hasn't happened already.
Yeah, that's happening. That's coming in 2020. That's Aaron Sorkin's The Nightly Show is already now taken as a title of a TV show. But it's going to be something like that. It's very much going to be the John Stewart style show. That is the next Aaron Sorkin project. All right. Well, Dom, very good stuff. Thank you so much for all of the information today and for sharing your takes and for filling us all in.
Yeah, it's rare that I get to use my political degree in a setting that also encourages very hot takes, but I found it at long last. And so,
yeah.
This is my home now.
All right, great stuff. Dom is, as usual, at DomHRV on Twitter. I am at Colin Stone. Dom, I'm out of stuff, so send us home.
Well, yeah, so all of your anger about me and everyone else destroying European civilization, direct that my way if you want. I'm happy to have a constructive discussion about it. I don't know how useful that would be, but, you know, it's... And let us know what you think about this episode, because, as we said, it's our first time discussing anything that is actually important outside of our narrow fandom. So, yeah, let us know what you think, and if you would want to hear something like this again, how you think it could be improved, and, you know, just all of your general constructive feedback, which is what you guys always give us.
All right, yeah, that's going to do it. Thanks once again for listening. Take care, everybody.
It's always tease, tease, tease. You're happy when I'm on my knees. One day is fine and next is black. So if you want me off your back, well, come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go?